Grab your Bibles and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And I know I've had some conversations with some folks. I don't have a ton of time to kind of negotiate this, but I just want to say I've had a bunch of folks recently be in conversations. They're new to church. It's kind of a new deal for them. Here's what I want to tell you that's weird about church, especially if you're new, is that it looks like one thing, but it's something else, right? It looks like, here, you got to understand, everybody's been thinking since last night what they were going to wear, and they got up early, they took showers, they're all cleaned up. And so we're all kind of cleaned up on the outside, but not so much on the inside. So some of you are wondering, hey, I wonder what's really the deal here? Can I fit in here? I mean, it looks like everybody's got everything together. They have a Bible. They know where 1 Corinthians is. That's all a little bit of an illusion, okay? So you got to give it some time, right? Our lives are just as jacked up as everybody else's. You'll find out soon enough, right? I need to pick up quickly where Bill left off last week, all right, in the middle of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Bill, I was at a couple of our different campuses last week, and so I heard 10 minutes here and 10 minutes there and 10 minutes there. And so I sat down on Monday and went through the sermon again. And let me tell you a key word that Bill pulled out. He said this. He was teaching through the first 16, 17 verses. He said, we have some cultural idols. And one of the cultural idols that he mentioned was the significance of a relationship. So country music's big on this. Rock and roll's big on this. We're going to write about relationships and how those are what define us. And, you know, You Light Up My Life, 1970-something, big song, right? And I can't have meaning without you. Life was miserable till you came along. I mean, how'd you like to be married to that person or be in a relationship with that person whose life was miserable till you came along? Right, that you're the one who fixes all that, okay? That's a lot of weight. So here's what we're doing. We have this cultural idol about relationships and what they can do for us, right? And so that's why we have so much brokenness, so many broken hearts, right? Here's what he's trying to say is that wherever you are, single, married, divorced, remarried, whatever all that is that in this job, that job, you like this, where you live here, don't live there, want big dream on this, wherever you are, is that Jesus is there with you and has even called you to that place, is going to do something in your life. And that circumstance, that situation is not what defines you. There's a new reality in him that defines you, all right, that's at a whole different place. So verse 17, I kind of pick up where he finished. This defines this whole chapter. He goes, each of you should continue to live in whatever situation the Lord has placed you. And notice he says, this is where he kind of owns it. He says, this is where the Lord has placed you. It's where you already were when you came to faith. But now he terms it as, this is where he's placed you. And remain as you were when God first called you. This is my rule for all the churches. All right. So the situation in life, the social status, political status, whatever, doesn't define us. Our relationship with Jesus does. Verse 20. He goes, and yes, each of you should remain as you were when God called you. Are you a slave? Don't let that worry you. In other words, if for them, that'd be a big deal, wouldn't it? Is that a lot of these are ex-slaves. I mean, getting your freedom from slavery would be a big deal. Now, this is not American slavery. This is a little different kind of slavery. Some of it's not that bad. Some of it was bad. But the opportunity, he goes, don't let that own you. Verse 21, he goes, are you a slave? Don't let that worry you. But if you get a chance to be free, then take it. Here's what he's saying. Everything's not exactly for Christians all the way over here, real black and white over here, or all the way over here, real black and white. He goes, listen. He goes, if you have a chance to get your freedom, that's great. That's a good thing. Take it. But here's also what he's saying in that. Don't let the gaining of your freedom become an idol in your life. You're like, do you know how important this is to me? Very important. He says, but don't let it own you. And so the application jumping out of that for us would be what? Is that there can be good things in our lives that become idolatrous. Having a spouse, being able to have children, getting to this job, getting that career, getting this degree, keeping that scholarship, whatever that thing is, the big dream, the big vision, whatever it is. And you go, well, that's not a bad thing. No, it's a good thing. Your freedom. Having your freedom is a good thing. So whatever the thing, whatever the dream is, whatever the vision is, it can become something that's so weighty that it owns us. Here's the big one, our health. It's to be able to have our health. When you start losing it, you start to clamor. Again, that can become a huge deal. So it can apply to any area of life. Verse 22. He goes, here's the bigger reality. He goes, and remember, if you were a slave when the Lord called you, you are now free in the Lord. Like, all right, that's a pretty good point. And if you were free when the Lord called you, you're now a slave of Christ. What's his point? Because that Jesus weighs in as a bigger reality than what your present physical circumstances are. So you may think you've got everything all together and you got money and you got power and you got all this. He goes, you're free. He goes, remember that that is kind of temporal. He goes, I wouldn't get lost in that because there's something bigger that binds you, that calls you to some responsibility and obligations, your relationship with Jesus. And if you're a slave right now, he says, well, you know, that presents some difficult circumstances right now, but it also means that don't get too upset about that because you have a bigger reality for all eternity. So he's trying to open their eyes to some things, right? So that all kind of sets the stage and connects with where we were last week, right? So here we go, 25. He goes, here's a real life example. And we'll work through some of these verses and we'll get to where it hits us. 25. He says, now regarding your question, in their letter back to him, regarding your question about the young women who are not married, I do not have a command from the Lord, which means what? Which means he's not quoting something that Jesus said from the Gospels or something that Jesus had said in another setting, because I'm not quoting Jesus. But the Lord in his mercy has given me wisdom that can be trusted. I'll share it with you. He's not just saying I'm giving you a good opinion. It's still inspired. And so we're getting some good questions about the the history, the authority of the Bible, and how is it put together. So let me give you a name, Bruce Metzger. If you like to study, you like to research, you're like, man, I'd really like to know more about how the Bible was compiled and put together. He was on staff at Princeton for like 35 years. He died back in 07, 97, has a 7 in it. Not trying to demean his life. We're standing on his shoulders here, right? You Google him. He's written a bunch of books, and he will talk to you. And so this is in Princeton, far from an evangelical or kind of school, but he has carried the weight of our thinking on some of this, of explaining how all this works. So some of you are real scholarly. You will enjoy your time with Bruce, all right? I did not so much, but he's saying, I'm not quoting Jesus, but still authoritative. 26. But of this present crisis, I think it's best to remain as you are. Because if you have a wife, do not seek to end that marriage. If you do not have a wife, do not seek to get married. He goes, just stay kind of where you are. You go, oh my goodness, what does all this mean? Well, he unpacks it. But if you do get married, it's not a sin. And if a young woman gets married, it's not a sin. He's saying, look, because if you said ideally what's best, if you're not married, stay that way. You're going to complicate your life. We'll unpack that in just a minute. He goes, if you are married, don't say, oh, I'm a believer now, and he's not a believer, she's not a believer, but I am, and so I've got this new spiritual world, so I'm going to cut them loose so I can be all that God's created me to be. He goes, no, don't do that either. He goes, you flourish, and you can flourish, not just survive. You can thrive in the environment and the circumstances in which you are in right now. All right, so that's his idea. Because back in 17, the Lord has placed you here. Verse 20, if you can get free from this slavery deal, that's fine, but don't let it become idolatrous to you. The present situation doesn't define you. And he gets Solomonic in verse 29. Don't worry, we're getting to the application stuff. You got to hang with me. Once we get there, you'll wish we were back here. He goes, let me say this, verse 29, dear brothers and sisters. The time that remains is very short. So from now on, those who have wives should not focus, those wives who are married should not focus only on their marriage. Verse 30, those who weep or rejoice or who buy things should not be absorbed by their weeping, by their joy, or by their possessions. 31, those who use the things of this world should not become attached to them. Here's big, big idea. Ready? In 30, he uses the word absorbed. In 31, he uses the word attached. All right, now he's speaking to them, but he is speaking to us. We'll read 30 again. Those who weep are going through a hard time. Someone has died. They've lost somebody. Someone's rejoicing. They just got married. Someone has bought something. They got a huge Christmas bonus. So they've gone out and bought a new car. He says, if you weep, if you rejoice, if you buy things, you should not be absorbed by their weeping or by the joy or by the possessions that they have. They should not become too attached to them. Here's the reality. Life has a consuming aspect to it. There's something about the life that we're living, the way we think, the way we're built, the way our hearts are created, that we attach to life, that we get absorbed in it, the best parts and the worst parts. And our hearts are built to wrap around something. The question is, are we letting it wrap around the correct thing? Are we getting absorbed into the right thing, or are we getting absorbed into the wrong things and attached to the wrong things? He goes, well, why? Why is this a big deal? What's the next sentence? for this world as we know it will soon pass away. He goes, because here, you're letting your heart get wrapped around things that have a short shelf life. Not going to be here very long. You're not going to be here very long. They're not going to be here. What's the theme of the book of Ecclesiastes? Even if you're really gifted and you can hang on to your stuff, the problem is your stuff can't hang on to you. Because it'll be here and you'll be gone. It'll transcend you. He says, so it's all and then ultimately everything's going to pass away. Excuse me. He goes, it's all going to pass away from us. He said, so that don't lean your heart on it. So a bunch of years ago, a guy in our congregation, Ray Blackston, had bought on some kind of deal this Austin Healey imitation kit car, Austin Healey deal with a big old souped up 302 engine in it, and, you know, that they took out of a Mustang, and big old Holley carburetor on it. And so he said, hey, this thing is really cool looking. He said, you and your wife, you've been working really hard. Why don't y'all take it for the weekend and go enjoy yourself? I was like, sure. I kept putting him off. I was like, no, I just take it for the weekend. Y'all have a great time. I was like, all right. So I took it for the weekend. We went up in the mountains, and it's a wonder I didn't wrap that thing around a tree, a mountain, something. I drove so fast till my wife was so car sick, me driving up and down mountains all over North Carolina. She's like, you're going to kill us. I was like, right, but we're going out in style, right? And everywhere we go, people, you know, we get out of the car. People would look at us and say, hey, is that your car? I'd be like, yeah, it is, actually. It's really awesome. Well, it is. Yeah, it is. And, but, you know, we had a good time for that weekend. But it never occurred to me, you know, I'm going to check the oil. Because, I mean, I've had it like 6 hours, right? I never thought, you know, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to go take it home and wax it up and put it in the garage and save it for my grandkids. That never even crossed my mind. What's, you know, let's make sure we're going to get these seats taken care of. Don't just be careful because I wasn't worried about any of that. Why? Because I only got it for 2 days. I'm just going to give it back to Ray. It's going to be his. It's not mine. So it never occurred to me to get really attached to this thing, as cool as it was. It's for 48 hours, how cool it made me look, right? Which is something. That's a big deal. You got to be cool to make me look cool. And so I just, it's going away. It wasn't mine. It was handed to me for a short season. And then I turned it over and haven't seen it since. Have no idea what he's done with it. Had never driven it again, never been. So it's passing away. He goes, you're wrapping your heart around things that are just getting passed away. It's going to go away, verse 32. He goes, I want you to be, what was the first word, absorbed and attached. Now he says this, I want you to be free from the concerns of this life. Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Whatever you pour your time and your energy and your money into, that thing will become very important. So, if something's very important to you that should not be important, what do you have to do? Stop putting your time and your energy and your money into it. Give it away, sell it, get rid of it, something. All right, if it's too important, that's what you have to do. And then if there's something that you know intellectually should be important to you, but it's not, what do you have to do? Take your money and put into it. Take your time and put into it. Take your energy and put into it. Because Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Our hearts wrap around these things. And here's the lesson. Is that he says, this person, he goes, the time remains very short in 29. So from now on, those with wives should focus not only on their marriage. He says, there's an aspect here, as important as marriage is, and he'll make the case all day long. Those who weep, those who rejoice, those who buy. He goes, you should live as though you're not weeping, as though you're not rejoicing, you're not buying. Here's what he's saying. And this is a hard word to use, but we got to be a smart crowd. We got to don't overstate what I'm saying, all right? Because I'm going to try to say it as clear as I can. It's a tough word to use, but this is the word we have to use. Is that there's a certain amount of detachment that should be a part of the Christian walk. You say we should be attached from everything. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying there's a certain amount of detachment that should be a part of our deal. Right, and so when you see Buddhism, particularly Zen Buddhism, this is where they've taken this idea. It's a core nugget, and they've taken it too far. They've said not necessarily evil, because that's a controversial idea, but pain. They would say the cause of all pain is our attachment to it, and you can see how they get there. Because if I have something, a baseball bat that I got from Babe Ruth, and it's signed, it's autographed, it's in my house, and someone breaks in and steals it. And I'm attached to it because it's so important to me. They steal it. Now I have pain. If they came in and stole it and I wasn't attached to it, then there'd be no pain, which would be another idea for evil for them. Okay, so that is that logical? In some ways, that is logical. Now, it doesn't deal with the issue of justice, and it means you live in an impersonal universe, and there's no real God out there that's been offended. Nothing really is sin. So that part's wrong. But here's what I'm saying. Not that we're that, but there's an aspect to it that we have a world that's passing away. So why are we so attached to everything, whether that's status, job, career? And so you go, well, if I lose my children, I mean, I'm really attached to them. I'm going to be broken. That is true. That's very true, all right? But it is something to consider, because he even says the weeping piece. So if you said to me, Matt, do you have a healthy detachment from your family? I'd say, no, I don't. Something we're going to have to work on, right? That's an area. But if you said, do you have a healthy detachment from your car? I'd be like, yeah, I just don't care about that. That's not one of my things, right? I got other sin issues. That's not one of them. So we all got to figure that out. We all got to work on that. Here's the big question for each of us. What if you lost it would wreck you? If you didn't have it, the job, the college that you want to get into, this certain achievement, the dream, the spouse, the child, the death of this person, what wrecks you? You're like, well, something should wreck us. That's true to a certain degree. That's right. That is true. But will we recover? Is God bigger than all that? Or do the present circumstances have to drive everything about us? So what is it for you? What is it that you lose it? It's particularly in the area of your status, your personal significance. What is it that you lose it and you do not recover? You hold the world, God, and everybody hostage because you have to have that. It means that's where your identity is. It means that's what you trust in. It's your functional savior. So he gives an example of detachment here. Next verse, next phrase in 31, 32. He goes, an unmarried man can spend his time doing the Lord's work and thinking how to please him. Why? What's significant about being unmarried? Well, he's not attached to something. So he can spend his time doing the Lord's work, thinking how to please him, 33. But a married man has to think about his earthly responsibilities, how to please his wife. He's not saying it's a bad thing about pleasing your wife. He just says it's a reality. 34, his interests are divided. Remember, detached, divided. These are big words. In the same way, a woman who is no longer married or has never been married can be devoted to the Lord and holy in body and spirit, but a married woman has to think about her earthly possessions, her earthly responsibilities, and how to please her husband. So like, you know, when I'm a teenager, not even a teenager, I'm 11 years old, right? I wake up at 12:30 at night, and I hear this banging in the kitchen. I heard it all the time. It drives me crazy. So this night, I get up, I'm like, I am so tired of this. So I walk into the kitchen, and there's my mom banging pans and pots together, washing dishes. I'm like, Mom, can I tell you something? I can't sleep. Can't sleep with you doing this. You wash dishes in the middle of the night, can't sleep. And she turns around and she goes, I'm really sorry about that. I taught school all day. I ran you and your siblings around all afternoon. Been handling y'all, helping y'all with your homework all night. After we cooked dinner, now I'm cleaning up from dinner. I'm sorry I'm up in the middle of the night taking care of you and that bothers you. I was like, well, let's try to work on it. Right? I mean, I'm completely oblivious. Here's a woman who is carrying more weight than I can possibly comprehend, right? Interrupting my sleep. She's not getting any sleep because she's having to take care of a family, a husband, children. She's working outside the home. She's doing 50 different things. I can't even comprehend the weight that she's carrying. He goes, so here's that. You take that same woman, you take all that responsibility off of her, and she can devote more time and energy to the interest. And those aren't bad interests. Those are good things, right? That got my siblings and me. It got us to this place, right? But she would have more time and energy to focus on other things. And so for that man who says, if I get married, have some kids, I'm going to have life insurance. Yes, you are. Well, to pay for that life insurance, I'm going to have to work more. Yes, you are. I mean, the responsibilities just start to pile up on you. So a man who mentored me, Hal Norton, who died last summer, he started Garden City Chapel 50 years ago. And I worked for him when I was in college, and we had talked about a bunch of things about life and marriage and singleness. He stayed single his whole life. He was married to his work, which is a really cool thing, and cool to see his life kind of play out as it did. And so we had talked about that for me, and then I found Vicky and thought, I may not be single my whole life, right? So I go back and renegotiate the deal with him. I'm like, hey, this is what's going on. We're thinking about getting engaged. And he said, well, he goes, this is great. He goes, she's great, you're great, all that's really great. And here's what he said. He represented this text so accurately. But he said, you got to understand this. He said, I'm always on the clock. That's what I signed up for. He goes, you marry her, you are not always on the clock. And I said, what does that mean? He goes, my phone rings at 3 a.m. He goes, I'm gone. He goes, I go handle it. Call in the middle of the day. He goes, I throw stuff in a bag. I drive to Georgia if I have to. I do whatever I got to do. He goes, that will no longer be you. He goes, you will have obligations and responsibilities that will limit you. He goes, and you love to be that person. He goes, so count this cost. You love to be the person who can pack it in and go, be the hero, whatever. He goes, you love that. He said, and some of that's going to go away. And he was right. And it's been a good thing. It's been a good thing. But there is a cost to it. And so that's the married reality. The single reality is, Paul's saying, I want you to be single so that you can serve. And so if you go to the average church and you say, hey, what is singles ministry in your church? We would say, well, singles ministry is where we bring a bunch of singles together and let them, you know, worship, Bible study, serve together, spend some time in fellowship. That's what singles ministry is. Paul would be like, okay, I mean, that's fine. That's not a bad thing. But in Paul's mind, singles ministry would be where there's a group of folks within our congregation because of their station in life, their situation in life, they carry the heavy lifting for the church. That they actually carry the most weight and the most responsibility. They're in all the key roles of the church. They are, you want to say, people going to do mission work, they're the ones going to do mission work. We have a new project that needs to be handled, they're the ones handling the new project. We have these big responsibilities that need to be taken care of. That's what singles ministry is that they carry the heavy weight and the heavy lifting for the church. He goes, that's what singles ministry would be. And so I'm not saying that singles don't need time together in groups, okay, because they do. Because there are specific needs that can be talked about and dealt with there. There's some camaraderie there and even the ability to find one another. All that's fine. What we have to do is make sure as a church that we don't corrupt the spiritual growth that Jesus is trying to bring about because of his calling on us. That is bigger than our specific circumstances and us trying to deal with our specific circumstances, all right? And so there's a married piece to this and a single piece to this I'll get to in just a minute, all right? Verse 35. He goes, I'm saying this for your benefit. Now hear the kindness in his voice. Not to place restrictions on you. Not to say that you have to be single. He goes, I want you to do whatever will help you serve the Lord best with as few distractions as possible. He's got a kingdom mindset. He's not putting law on us. He's going to say, this is good, and this is better, and it's okay. 36, if a man thinks he's treating his fiance improperly and will inevitably give in to passion, let him marry her as he wishes. It's not a sin. He goes, marriage is not a bad thing. Far from it. It's a good thing. He goes, if you want to be married, get married. All right, now I throw that out there, and that's worth about 10 emails on me. All right? You want to be married? Get married. I mean, I'll get blistered for that. But here's the reality. It is a simple statement, and there's a lot of truth behind it. Here's the counterpart of while I'll get blistered on that, which is fine, and I got to take that. But the reality is this. Let me show you how complicated it is. The way that our culture has evolved and moved is that we're now in a place where men, young men, are not all young men who are 25, just as a culture, we're getting married later and later, and a lot of it pertains to this, is that young men, 25-year-old, 28-year-old, when they think about, they want to be with someone, physically, that sounds good, emotionally, that sounds good, but when they begin to intuitively feel, this is what it's going to mean to my life, I'm going to have to carry some weight and some responsibility. I'm going to have to deal with some things that I don't have to deal with right now. I'm going to have to shoulder some things and solve some problems I don't have to solve right now. So that's what's coming at me. And that becomes so weighty on their shoulders that the physical and emotional attraction just goes way down. And they're like, yeah, I mean, that's great, but not great enough to balance out the fact that I'm going to have to carry this weight. Right? So we have a lot of men, so I have some young men look at me and go, so you're just saying we just need to suck it up and get married. I was like, I'd like to say that. Okay, I have said that. I'll own that. But I'll recognize there's something systemically broken about our culture, which leaves a whole bunch of women who feel like they have a clock that's ticking. They want to be a part of something. They want to be a part of this relationship, but men are not pursuing in that way. So they find themselves being a little bit desperate, which is not attractive. And they'll find themselves compromising physically and emotionally to get some needs met because it's the best they can get. And he'll compromise physically and emotionally to get some needs met. And so we have this kind of mediocre version of quasi-relationship that's not really have some teeth and substance to it. And so we have people kind of lost, especially in their 20s. So we're struggling right there. Some of that is legitimate. Some of that really needs to be dealt with, right? There's some big, big questions that surround that. He says, if you want to get married, then get married. But I recognize, even when I say that, it's a complicated deal that we're going to spend some more time unpacking. But 37. But if he's decided firmly not to marry, and there's no urgency and he can control his passion, he does well not to marry. So if the person who marries his fiance, he does well. The person who does not marry does even better. So in a church like ours, where singles would say, and I think legitimately so, we feel like second-class citizens, that was not a biblical design. If anything, from a biblical framework, singles should feel like first-class citizens, and married folks should feel like second-class citizens. So if you felt that, and you have, then we get that. We see that. 39, a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. If the husband dies, she's free to marry anyone she wishes, but only if he loves the Lord. So give me a moment to camp on that. Because, I mean, how much are we struggling in our culture with Christians marrying non-Christians? Or Christians marrying people who say that they're Christians so that they can get married? And she's like, oh, okay, well, he says he is. And, but she's dragging him to church, and there's no real spiritual fire in his soul. There's nothing that comes from inside of him out. Everything is from the outside being forced in. And so we got all that. Well, let me give you kind of how that goes. Our big fear has been, traditionally, is that sweet little Christian girl is going to marry a non-Christian guy, and he's going to bring all this corruption and sin. He's going to destroy her and their relationship. Okay, does that happen? Yes, it happens. It's really not as common as you think, but it does happen. All right? More than likely, what will happen is a sweet Christian girl will marry a non-Christian guy, even if he says he's a Christian and gets married and all that. They'll just kind of dissolve into a mediocre-ness. Nothing dynamic. Nothing really exciting that's going on. Nothing really vibrant when it relates to spiritual things. And it's just kind of mediocre, right? But most often, here's what happens. Is that sweet little Christian girl marries non-Christian guy. And they make it work for about 10 years. And then as it turns out, when we get down the road, sweet little Christian girl, she's actually the one who destroys the relationship. And so as much counsel as I give to Christians about you shouldn't marry a non-Christian because you're unequally yoked and that's not what God wants and how does this have a partnership with this, that whole deal, I tell non-Christians, you don't want to marry her. You do not want to marry her. She will destroy you. Because here's what will happen. She's going to play a game with you for about 10 years and then she's got 3 kids that she's got to take care of and she's going to get concerned about their soul. And she's going to want something spiritual to happen. And she's going to be tired of leading in the area of spirituality. And she's going to come after you and start putting pressure on you to be some kind of spiritual leader. And you don't even believe in any of that. You had church in a box, and now she doesn't want church in a box. She wants you out front being something spiritual. And here's the deal. She's going to get arrogant and prideful. She's going to look down her nose at you and think that she's better than you because she's been to 50 Beth Moore Bible studies, and you ain't done anything. And she's going to know all this Bible. She's going to quote verses to you. She's going to tell you how you should be. And she's going to tell you what it means to be a spiritual leader. And it's going to be some jacked up, feminized version of all that. And she's going to be, and he's like, oh, I'm done with her. I'm good. Yeah, no need to get married. I was like, I'm just telling you. She's going to change the deal. And we've seen it. They come into the office, and they're 12 years into it, and it's falling apart. And she's got a list, a laundry list of what an idiot he is and how he's not doing this and this and this. And you look at him, and he's like, I don't know what happened. He goes, I mean, what I signed up for was A and A. And now it's A, I'm still A, and now she's B. He goes, she has changed the deal. And so when he says that, I'm like, well, I said, can you see what he's saying? That, when y'all started, you were an A and he was an A. Now you're a B. You've changed. Something's changed. You've changed the deal. She's like, well, I just thought we were both going to change. I was like, did you sign up for change? He's like, I did not sign up for change. So let me just say, as much for Christians as it is for non-Christians, You can't look at it for a 2-year deal. We're going to be together for about 5 years. If we want to be together for 50 years, we might want to start out kind of with this in the same place, thinking this is where it's all going to kind of wind up. We have no guarantees, right? But he says, that's why he says it. Make sure that he loves the Lord. Verse 40. In my opinion, it would be better for her to stay single. He goes, and I think I'm giving counsel from God's Spirit. Why does he want to be single? Last time. Because there's ministry opportunities that are much greater for her if she's single. Him too. All right, so let me give some application. I got a few minutes left. The first is this. I'm going to talk to singles in our church. Not in other churches, not in other places, other cities, all that. Okay, our church. Singles, I talk to marrieds. But here's the thing, we're organically connected. So if we can't have one group change without the other group changing. So we all got to kind of be self-aware at the same time. So let me start with marrieds, all right? Let me start with marrieds in our church. Here's the reality. As a church, marrieds, we do not interact well with singles. As a church. Now, some of you are like, well, I do. I hear you. But overall, as a church, we don't integrate well. We don't interact well. We don't connect well. So it feels like a couple different churches. There's the couples church with two kids who are coming in out of the children's building. And those couples are always together. And they're really cliquish. And they go out to lunch together. And they eat dinner together. And they spend all their time together. And they're really, really cliquish. And so singles are on the outside of that. Not only are singles, but empty nesters are also feeling on the outside of that. And then couples who have not been able to have children, have chosen not to have children for whatever reason, they feel on the outside of that too. And so when we look at singles, sometimes we'll say, look, there's a lot of selfishness here. You're self-focused. You're doing this and this. Everything's about you and your freedom. And you're here today, gone tomorrow, doing all this, real transient, blah, blah. Here's the thing. We model some of the same kind of selfishness as couples that we're frustrated with singles about, right? So we're together. And not including, not connecting, not seeing the value in what it means for us to integrate and be together as a church. So we need to learn how to interact better, because here's why. We need to learn how, as couples, to engage and encourage the singles around us. Now, singles are going to have to get a vision for some of this. I hear you, because we've had folks reach out at times. But there are things, as a married person, that you have to say to encourage this person who's single. That you get to walk back in time and say, okay, here's what it was like for me to go from this world to this world. Here's some of the things I wish that I knew. And get to encourage them when they're in a difficult spot, when there's a lot going on, when they need some encouragement. We get to interact with them, interface with them, and be in community with them. It's very important. Here's the other thing. Not just to encourage them, but also to challenge them. Is that we need a voice with our single brothers and sisters to be able to say, here's what you're saying, here's what you're thinking, here's what you're doing, and let me tell you how most of that is wrong. How in 10 years, you are not going to be happy with some of the decisions that you're making right now. And so we're going to have to find the community that gives us credibility to be able to speak to one another. That what I have found personally is a tremendous blessing in my relationship with single guys and single gals in our church. All right? I have been served personally incredibly well. There have been times where my wife and I needed to be away on a retreat for 3 days. And to have some singles, they were the only people who could give that kind of time. Leah Pinckney, poor thing, come in and take care of my 4 or my 5 kids for 2 or 3 days. All right? And just her just being willing to handle it so that I can go do my job. And there have been times where I couldn't go do my job without Vicky being there. And for her to come in and carry that kind of weight. She's not the only one. I could name a handful who have just kind of carried weight for us. And they were the only people who could free up the kind of time for that amount, for those days, that could kind of carry that weight for us. So it was huge, very important. Here's what else I've learned in the last couple of years. From the two, the guy and a gal, two singles that we're closest to, Vicky and I have learned more about parenting in the last 2 years than we've learned in a long time. For one gal who's early 20s, another guy who's mid to late 20s, to be able to look at them, for them to be able to say to us, I don't know if you know this, but here's how the world works now. Because for us, we had 4 kids like this. I mean, and then a 5th one a little bit later, but a decade just kind of went away on us. Right? I mean, all we did was change diapers and clean up throw up for like 10 years. And sure enough, the world kept going and evolving and changing out there. And we're like, what? It's like we came up out of the water. It's like, hey, look, there's a world here. Hey, because we've been down there doing our thing. And for them to say, I don't know if you know this, but kind of, and so helping us get ready for how we equip our teenagers to engage this world that we were not clear on what all's going on. But here's the other part of it. is that to be able to say, look at what these folks missed coming out of the homes they came out of, good homes, right? But what they missed, hey, we're doing the same thing with our children. We could do a better job. There's some things that they're now facing that they need to deal with. We need to equip our children to deal with that. So that has been a huge blessing, and that's not something they came in to teach us. It's just how God has used the community of being together. Here's the thing. We don't need a program for this. We don't need a bunch of sign-ups on a sheet of paper and force people together. You need to seek out one another. We need to pray and say, God, cross my path with the right people, whoever they are, so that we can be in community together. All right, so to our singles, I'll say this. That's to the marrieds. You do have a mission, and it is to serve in the local church and not just be served. Do you need time together as singles? Yes, we're acknowledging that. And you go, well, what does that look like? Send me an email. I'll get you connected to a couple singles groups in our church that meet. So I can't find singles. I don't know what's going on. You send me an email. Go on our website, M. Williams. You get that. Send it to me. We'll get you connected to some folks, right? So that can happen. So I'm acknowledging that. But overall, the call on this passage is not for you to be served. And you will be served in the process of serving and learning how to give your life away. Us creating another youth group that's just for singles is not going to facilitate the discipleship process. Okay, that's not going to move us farther along. Here's what we got to do, is we got to challenge you to focus on becoming a certain kind of person as more important than finding a certain kind of person. Now, you got to find a certain kind of person, but we got to be that person first. And so here's what I tell singles, is that if you really want to get married, then the most important thing you can do is spend time with married folks. They're like, well, Matt, you got to think through it a little bit. If I'm with married folks, I can't marry either one of them. I'm like, I hear you. But God doesn't do math like that. Nowhere in the Bible does God do math like that. Gideon, he's got thousands of warriors. I need him to take 300. Like, how's 300 going to beat all them? God just doesn't do math the way we do it. Because here's what happens when you're with married folks and you're in their home, not just at lunch. Okay, but when you're really with them, you see and hear things and you're thinking, I didn't even know that was possible, but I want that. You're getting clear on what you want, what you need, what's really important in a relationship. Your eyes start getting more clear. You're like, okay, that's really good right there. What he just said to her, that I want that. But you wouldn't have known that if you hadn't been there. And as you're getting clear about what you want, and you're seeing it kind of fleshed out, you're changing in the process. And so when someone else sees you, they're like, look at that. Look at who he is. Look at who she is. That's what I want. You're becoming more attractive in a way that's really, really healthy. All right, so that's the first idea. Spend more time with married folks. Second idea, you need to get connected to local church. The announcement comes up for discovery. You need to grab a piece of paper. You need to grab the guest card. And you need to fill it out and come to discovery. You need to be a part of local church. Well, when I grow up, when I stop traveling so much, when I stop doing this, when I start doing this, then I'll get involved. No, you need to get involved now and become part of a community group. All right, and that's where you'll find mentors and people to connect with. All right, you need to be involved in men and women's ministry. Here's what you would say. Well, men's and women's ministry is always directed towards people who are married and who have children. Okay, here's what I'll say. You're right. All right, and here's what else I'll say about that. 80% of our teaching about two singles, about marriage and children, needs to stay exactly that way. About 20 to 25% of that needs to change. And here's what I tell you, it's changing right now. Women's ministry is being written in a way that we show that femininity is bigger than just being married and having children. Our men's curriculum is being rewritten in such a way to help show that masculinity is bigger than just being a husband and having children. So all that is, we hear that, we're getting that. It takes a while to get clear on how all that works, but we are figuring that out, right? And then I want to throw out some opportunities for you to serve. Not just being a part of church, not just being a part of community, but giving your life away, right? Some of our singles that are in the services, particularly on Pelham Road campus, you need to come on Saturday night and serve in our children's ministry. Because you can. Because you're done at 7:30 and you can still go out. Right? I mean, that's why we put it so early. I'd love to have it later. There's tons of opportunities for you to serve. Our student ministry takes gobs of time to be able to connect with students. All right, you got to be out a couple nights a week. You got to be over here. You got to do all this. And so you can work that in. And so student ministry, children's ministry. And what I would say is, you come in and look at our church, and it looks so couple-oriented and so established. It was started with singles. Singles carry the heavy weight in this church. I look around this room and see some folks who are married now. I remember when you were 23 and what you were doing and how you carried weight in our church. And so for when we were at the YMCA on Cleveland Street, we met in this huge gym, about 300 people, met in this huge gym, and it would be freezing cold on a day like this. And what they call heaters, we call fans. All they're doing is moving cold air. And here's what we would do. We had keys to the Y and the alarm code. Two of our single guys, Roger Throckmorton, Rusty Gloss, would get up at 2 a.m. They would drive to the gym with the key. They don't work for the Y, they work with us, right? Open, volunteers, open the gym, turn off the alarm, go down, hook up two kerosene heaters that will burn for 8 hours to heat that huge gym. Some of you have been in there, you know it's massive, right? And it would just take the chill off. They would put the code back on, lock the door, go back, get in the bed at 3 o'clock. Then they'd get up at 8 o'clock, come to church. We'd start at 10:30. And people would be like, man, it sure does stink in here. Right, but we're not freezing to death. There's trade-offs. All right? And so what they did was they freed me up to be able to, when my kids wake up in the middle of the night sick, we had young kids, freed me up to be able to handle that, get a good night's sleep so I can come in and teach the next day. Not teach well, but teach. I did it, right? We need people to come in and do 5 hours of administrative work, come in and help paint, tear carpet out, do all that. Let me give you some big ones. We need some folks to go live in Kenya for a year or two and help facilitate what we're doing there with Bernard Kabaru. Okay? God may call any of us to move to Kenya, but some of us can get there a little quicker and a little easier than others. All right? We need some folks who will move to Allendale. We thought, what if we sent one single person to Allendale to help facilitate our ministry down there? That'd be great. Then we thought, what if we sent a couple down there? All right, this married couple. Or what if we sent a family down there? And then we're like, what if we sent a whole team of folks, six or seven folks down there who could live in Allendale and help just teach school, be a part of ministry that we're doing down there? What would that be like? So he can call any of us, but some of us can get there a little easier. Here's the thing. We have about 12,000 people who live in apartments within 5 miles of this campus, the Pelham Road campus. Okay, and so what would it be like? We have a ministry talking to us saying, hey, we can get apartments for basically free rent if you'll get two guys, two gals, a married couple, young, 70, doesn't matter, who will live in that apartment complex and help facilitate ministry in that apartment complex. We have almost no people who live in the apartments around us come to church here. I mean, the ministry opportunities for us are huge, and some of it can't be done by just anybody. So you go, hey, I want to talk some more about that. You got a guest card, email, website, you let us know. Here's what we're saying. You go, this is kind of radical. It is in this sense. If you have a worldly predisposition. But if you come to this table and you say, this is Jesus' body for me, this is his blood for me. This is no longer my kingdom, this is his kingdom. This is no longer my identity, this is his identity. No longer my agenda, this is his agenda. The present circumstances that I have been given up to him for him to use in whatever way benefits and blesses him and his kingdom, then coming to the table really makes sense. So I'll pray and we'll sing and we'll meditate. You come when you're ready. Remembering this, if you're visiting, I mean, you know Jesus, it's an open table, you can come. If you're not a Christian, this table is not really for you. It's a chance for you to watch people embrace the gospel of a life they couldn't live and a sacrifice that was made to pay for their sins. Let's pray. Lord, we ask that now as we come, as we sing, you would continue to open our hearts and stir us towards you. You would show us what it means to love you, not just in our words, but also from the deepest places of our soul. And then it's not just to be able to say it comes from the soul, but to be able to walk out and to live it. And what would it mean for us to say, the gospel is not just something I do when I sing, not just something I believed when I was 10 years old. It's not just coming to this table. It's that this table means something bigger about my life, that my life is given over to you because you bought me, you gave your life to me. So, Father, show us what it means to give our lives to you, to serve you, to love you, not just with words, but with actions. We ask it in your name.